Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls, or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles, or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. I'm going to talk about Ali Harbi Ali. He is a British man, but he's a British man with Somali heritage. And he lived in North London. And he hit the headlines last year in an act of terror that literally shocked the nation. It didn't just shock the nation with respect, it shocked the world. So his family, they fled war-torn Somalia in the 1990s. His father had actually been a senior government official in Somalia. He was the director of communications at the office of the Prime Minister. So he had a very, very important role. Ali grew up in a small terraced house in Croydon, South London. And he had what would be considered an archetypal childhood. As a child, he attended Parish Church Junior and Infant School in Croydon. And he and his siblings were actually some of the first Muslim pupils to attend the school. So that would have been, I imagine, a culture shock to some degree. But certainly, he didn't have issues at that school. He fitted in very, very well, was very accepted, and thrived. He was described by his teachers as a really hard-working child. He wasn't a high-flying academic student, but notably, he was good at maths, something that I never achieved. Maths and me still do not get on. We are not friends. Also, behaviour was great. He literally never got into any trouble whatsoever. Mindset and mannerism-wise, well, very polite, very friendly. He was liked by his peers. He got on with all his classmates. And he seemed to have a very westernized lifestyle. He enjoyed his life as a child. And certainly there is nothing that stood out about him during those early years that caused anyone concern. In fact, one would say quite the contrary. He was an individual who was well-liked, abided by the rules, and was somebody who was seen as a benefit to his school. Also, even though he was Muslim, he was really happy to get involved with the Christian ethos of the school, and he sang hymns that were Christian. So we see a normal developing childhood totally assimilated and integrated into his world of school. Ali then went to secondary school in Croydon. Again, that's in South London. And his friends described him as quiet, but he was one of those young men who wasn't at all aggressive. In fact, he was described as having a gentle vibe. So again, we're being painted a picture of a young man growing into a really pro-social teenager. He didn't get into trouble. And when he hung out with friends, they were all known to be high achievers. So he hung out with the good kids, the kids who were gonna make something of their lives. He wouldn't have hung out with me at school. Let's put that into context immediately. I was in the strange corner with the subculture kids. We didn't quite know where we were going or what we were doing, but we certainly weren't clever enough to be with the group of high achievers. It's also worth noting, at this point, he was not overly religious and there was no political viewpoints that were obvious to people who knew him. There's always that kid at school, isn't there? You know, certainly at my school there was, I'm sure at your school there was. Well, like at nine, there, I'm gonna be prime minister. And by 13, they're running some kind of groups in school and ultimately they're the head kid. Aren't they? They've had that trajectory since they literally came out of the womb and they will not settle until they are in number 10 Downing Street. Yeah, he wasn't anything like that. He excelled in his first 5 years at school. So when he went to his secondary school, he did well, but he did start to show a decline and that was in sixth form. Again, this is not unusual. Sixth form presents itself in different ways to different people. Some children, they thrive, do their A-levels, and just go on skipping and hopping to university, to Freshers' Week, and then it all goes downhill when they realise that they can get beer for a quid. But others get to 16, 17, 18, and the world shifts and changes. You start to take it more seriously, or you start hanging out with people that, shall we say, take you on a different path, and what was once a great attender becomes a problem attender. I'm not saying that I was that kid. I was that kid. I was that kid actually from 13, but that's another story. But the point is, he's seen to change in his behaviour. And one of the results of this is his A-levels are actually poorer than he expects to achieve. But nonetheless, he's still able to attend City University to study radiotherapy. So even though he might not have got exactly what he wanted, he's a bright boy. And he has clearly an incredibly bright future ahead of him as long as he sticks to that path. But for whatever reason, he doesn't remain at university and he drops out in 2016. So we're seeing a change in how he's feeling, just about his future per se. I think one of the things that we note in certain young people is they have a very clear idea of where they're going and what they want to do and be. My youngest son has two really close friends. They're twins, and they have forever wanted to be a neurosurgeon and a plastic surgeon. Literally, when they could talk, they decided on that path, and they are at college, and that is where they are going. And I have no doubt whatsoever that I will be a customer of theirs in the future with heavily discounted rates as far as the plastic surgery is concerned. I have already subliminally processed them with that knowledge, and I mean it. I don't think they're taking me seriously, but they will when I turn up for an appointment and demand a heavy reduction on my complete body lift. I'm probably going to look like Claudia Schiffer by that point, in her 1980s time. Not now, although that would still be okay. But for other kids, even if you think you know where you're going, life has these twists and turns, and you formulate new ideas, and the things that you felt had meaning to you change and transition. So even though it's a situation where he's dropped out of university, ultimately lots of kids do. It doesn't mean necessarily there's anything going on, but if you start thinking that a future isn't really something you envisage, well, that can be a different reason for dropping out. If the qualifications that you're looking to achieve are gonna get you nowhere because you don't believe you're going to have a future to go anywhere, then that's a much more sinister reason for dropping out. Despite the fact that this young man had grown up in the UK, despite the fact that all the way through his young life, he showed absolutely no signs whatsoever of terrorist group ideologies, an 18-year-old Ali was radicalized online between 2014 and 2016. This radicalization began basically when he saw coverage of the Syrian war. This provoked wanting to know more about it. And innocently, initially, he starts to watch issues relating to the Syrian war, but this takes him down that rabbit hole. And he eventually starts watching terror-related material online. And as many of you will know, it is terrifying, the kind of information, the video footage that you can find online. And also, radicalization is a huge threat to children and young people, because the internet is full of these rabbit holes that take you on a trajectory that they wish to take you on. It doesn't matter whether it's based in fact, it doesn't matter whether it's full of misinformation. What matters is it hooks the person in, and then from hooking them in, it starts to sway their attention in the direction that they wish for them to travel. And what happens is he starts to develop this sympathy for the terrorist organisation ISIS And obviously that's later become known as Islamic State. But for any of us who have been around and seen that, for people like me who've gone and visited Ground Zero, where the Twin Towers used to be in New York, it brings it home, the damage and destruction that occurs through these organisations. I also appreciate that the information that we are given in the UK and in the Western world is very much biased towards our experience. But there will be people who have different levels of sympathy and empathy to organisations that we find abhorrent because of their experiences. And I will not pretend that I am an expert on all things to do with terror. It wouldn't be pertinent and correct for me to say so. But all I'm saying is that there are reasons why people feel angry with the Western world. If you think about the fact that Tony Blair and the Bush administration in the States invaded a country by pretending that there were weapons of mass destruction. Arguably, whether they were absolutely knowledgeable as individuals that was the case, who knows? Although it seems really strange to me that leaders of a country wouldn't acknowledge that when they were signing orders to invade, they would need to have sight of the reality of the reason behind why they were invading, such as knowing that there really were weapons of mass destruction. But nonetheless, certainly our actions in the West haven't always been the best, and we have to have sympathy and empathy with people who feel angry about that. That being noted, there will never be any acceptability where terrorism is concerned. I live in Manchester. I literally was personally affected by the Manchester Arena bombing, and my son lost a friend. So when you know these things about terror, it's very hard to have any sympathy and empathy with those individuals who support them. By early 2014, Islamic State had expanded its operations into Syria, and it had occupied territories in the eastern provinces. It basically established its central military command in a place called Raqqa. That's a city in Syria on the northeast bank of the Euphrates River. And it's here that the Islamic State declared its caliphate. That means the rule by a political, religious Islamic leader. Now, the conflict in Syria had actually begun a few years earlier. It began in March 2011. An Arab Spring began in 2010. And this was something that had seen a wave of pro-democracy protests. There were lots of uprisings across the Middle East, across North Africa. There were protests in Tunisia, in Egypt, and they actually toppled their regimes as a result. So it was huge. The conflict started in Syria when its government was also challenged by pro-democracy protests. The protesters demanded that they wanted to see the end of President Assad's authoritarian regime. They were tired of having somebody who was a dictator. They wanted to have an opportunity to elect leaders. And that makes perfect sense to me. Having had a few years of feeling like there is an authoritarian government who tells you what you are allowed to do and what you are not allowed to do, I say democracy is a great thing. But in countries where there is no democracy, understandably at times, people will challenge the regime. Sadly, when you challenge somebody like President Assad, predictably, you will be met with violence. And that's exactly what happens. Opposition militias then form in 2011, because clearly when the government is being violent towards their people, who are basically just asking for a fair opportunity to vote in people that they actually believe have their vested interests at hand, they are going to respond with violence back, because it's not okay for the government to do that. So these militias form, and then by 2012, the conflict has become civil war. That's between the Syrian government, which has been backed by Russia and Iran, and the anti-government rebel groups, who are backed by United States, of course, are always in there, United States and Britain usually, but United States in this case, Saudi Arabia, Turkey and others who are actually in that region. So against this backdrop, Islamic State began seizing control of the territory in Syria. That's in 2013. And after terrorist attacks by Islamic State across Europe, which I'm sure many of you listening to me right now absolutely will remember the heinous impact of those terrorist attacks across Europe, the United States, the UK and France expand military attacks against the terrorist organisation. Around the same time, the UK government decided to vote in favour of various measures that are all around offering military support to countries to try to fight the threat posed by the Islamic State. In September 2014, the MPs get together and they vote positively. So they agree to provide military support to Iraq, where Islamic State originated. They also sanction airstrikes. In December 2015, due to the threat that Islamic State poses to international peace and security, the MPs then vote to sanction airstrikes against the terrorist organisation in Syria. So a huge amount of upheaval going on as far as politics, policies and impact of those policies on people. Because we always have to remember that when airstrikes are being commanded and when wars are being fought, as much as on one level you can say, well, soldiers are the people who are being impacted on, people who risk their lives for their country, actually civilians are often the individuals who are paying the greatest price. Think about the Ukraine right now. It's people who are just going about their daily lives who have these horrible scenarios play out, who lose members of their family because they're just walking down the wrong street at the wrong time. And I think it's really imperative that whenever we talk about war, we're remembering that the human cost, the people who are not invested in any of that, they just want to live their lives, is enormous. Now, by this point, Ali really was on the way to being fully radicalised. He was massively against these measures that were being taken in government. So he starts to form this idea and this identity with jihad. And initially he had planned to carry out jihad and he was going to travel to Syria. He was going to join in the holy war. But he decides that he's going to abandon this plan. And the main reason for that is, as many of you will know, people who fitted certain descriptions were often stopped and checked regarding their story as to why they were going to a certain place, and that could result in an individual being arrested because they are considered a potential suspect involved in terror. Lots of countries across Europe were investigating young people at risk of radicalisation and then just banning them from travelling abroad, literally taking their passports off them. And that was because they feared that they would leave the country, become very radicalised wherever they had gone to be trained, and then return to carry out the terrorist attacks on home soil, so to speak. So it made sense that they were doing that, but for him that was problematic. He felt that if he went ahead and was arrested, it would thwart his plans, but also it would thwart his plans and he would be on somebody's radar. So it would be something that failed to get him where he wanted to go, and it would also alert the authorities to who he was and what he was potentially planning. A great example of an individual who did get radicalised when they travelled overseas was Shamima Begum. So she left East London in 2015 and she decided that she wanted to join Islamic State. She was 15 when she did this. She was a kid. Now, when all played out and she actually survived, even though her partner died, all three of her children also died, she actually lost her right to return to the UK. She was even stripped of her UK citizenship. So she paid the ultimate price for wanting to travel and join Islamic State. And arguably, the UK decided that they wanted to try to prevent other individuals ending up in similar situations. No matter what your thoughts about that girl are, I think one of the things that we can all agree is at 15, lots of us do really stupid things, even though that was massively extreme, going and joining a terrorist organisation. Having said that, like I said, I think she has arguably paid the ultimate price and she has no place that she can actually call home now. Not defending terrorism in any way, shape or form, but I do think that we have to acknowledge that radicalisation is something that can happen to young people when they have developing brains and they can make some really poor choices, believing that they're doing the right thing. So Ali has obviously gone through this period of being radicalised over these years, and he's decided that he doesn't want to travel overseas to risk getting arrested. So instead, he's going to get involved in a form of domestic terrorism. And he's actually going to do this in accordance with the online advice of the Islamic State spokesperson. Literally, they have manuals, they have videos, they have specific ways that you can learn what you should do, how you should do it, and of course, what the consequences of your success will mean for you. And kids can find this online every single day of the week. In 2016, after this period of radicalization, Ali goes to Argos and he buys a 12-inch kitchen knife and he starts carrying it with him in his shoulder bag. It's not that he's going to use it at that moment in time. He wants to have it with him all the time so that if he gets to that point where he just wants to carry out the attack, he is ready. Also, I think it's a confidence experience because we see this with serial killers. They will often have a kill kit in the car with them for months and months before they use it. It's bolstering their confidence that they aren't going to be found out. It reminds them that they have the potential to carry out the attack. They can live in the fantasy state without actually going ahead and doing it, but it builds the confidence because they may have driven that route or walked that route 1,000 times and they've never been stopped. So the nerves about having it with them decrease and that confidence increases, which makes them more dangerous because they feel more psychologically prepared. In October 2017, one of the things that is very clear is that Islamic State are suffering lots of very, very heavy defeats. They lose a lot of territory, and this includes the stronghold that they have in Raqqa. At this point, clearly, they want to make up ground elsewhere. So its spokesperson therefore starts to encourage foreign nationals to carry out acts of terrorism. They call them lone wolf attacks. So they know that they haven't got the military aptitude or stronghold to actually keep hold of the territories that they wish to retain, but what they do know is they can do untold damage if they load a gun of an individual and then send that individual out to pull that trigger. If you think about the Manchester bomb arena, that one young man walked in and decimated the lives of so many. That was an individual who had been loaded up with all of this information and had completely lost sight and ration when it came to the reality of what they were doing based on all of these lies that they were told about what they would be granted in the next life if they went ahead and martyred themselves. I mean, terrorist and martyr are literally so far away from one another when it comes down to the way that people see them and perceive them. But nonetheless, that's what lone wolves are all about. The whole point of this is to get people to act alone in the commission of a terrorist attack. So rather than carry out his jihad in Syria, Ali resolves at this point that he's going to carry it out in the UK. But of course, if he's going to have an impact, if he's going to go ahead and carry out this act of jihad in the UK, he wants to make sure that it makes waves. So he needs to identify his target very, very carefully. Between the 1st of May 2019 and the 28th of September 2021, he meticulously plans his act of terrorism, and he decides that he's going to have a big impact by killing one or more members of parliament. He, in his mind, decides that the reason that he's going to choose members of parliament is it's going to act as revenge for the airstrikes in Iraq and Syria against Islamic State. So therefore, he feels, I need to select an MP who's voted in favour of the military action. So he feels that they have got a direct responsibility for carrying out these acts to a country that he pledges his allegiance to an organisation he pledges his allegiance to. And in his head, he seems to have this bizarre idea that if he goes and kills somebody who's a member of parliament, it will further his particular aim, which is to influence the government and also to advance this ideological cause that he believes in. I mean, it's completely delusional. Killing a member of parliament is not going to do any of those things. It's going to do the absolute opposite. It's going to confirm their beliefs about Islamic State. But nonetheless, this is what he believes. So he begins preparing. So as part of Ali's preparing, he actually undertakes reconnaissance of locations of targets to attack. He researches online and he even manages to establish MPs' addresses. And when you actually take a step back and think about that, it is really scary, isn't it? Because MPs genuinely many times are trying to do good things for the world. I know that I have my views and you have your views about particular MPs that we may not connect with, shall we say. But a vast amount of these individuals want to better the world. And the fact that they may have views that other people disagree with, and you can just Google and find out where they live, that does put them at risk. And bear in mind, Ali all this while is carrying his knife with him when he's scoping out those locations, so he could strike at any moment in time. And all this time that he's doing these exercises to scope out potential victims, Ali's not even on MI5's radar. Now, at this point, MI5 had more than 3,000 SOIs, subjects of interest, so to speak. And they may have had as many as 600 live investigations at any one time. Ali, in spite of the fact that he's been radicalized and is carrying a knife and is scoping out all these individuals, is not one of those SOIs at this moment in time. He's not even a concern for security agencies. He's got no previous criminal convictions. He's never been a person of interest in any way, shape, form, doesn't even have a caution. What had happened though is back in 2014, Ali had actually been referred to the government's Prevent scheme. Now, that Prevent scheme is a program which is aimed at stopping radicalization. He was still in education at the time, but people had started to notice that he was being drawn towards some Islamist ideologies, and it was concerning. So he actually went through a de-radicalisation course. It lasted a few months. They felt they'd done their job, and his case was then closed. I do wonder why they didn't keep, shall we say, tabs on an individual that had provoked interest by those who knew him in a way that made them concerned he was potentially being radicalized, to a point where he ended up on a program to de-escalate those feelings. One would imagine that it would probably be a good idea to keep in touch with those individuals. I actually know a psychologist who works with the Home Office on these issues, and I always feel that if you're gonna recognize that these individuals are at risk, no matter what programs they go through, you should constantly be monitoring them. And that might be an invasion of privacy, but it's for their own good as well as it's for the wider society's good. We don't want children and young people believing in these horrific organisations that teach them to go out and do untold damage and harm to our society. We don't want them ending up serving long sentences in prison because of the fact that they got involved in these things. So I think that monitoring is really integral and important. Now, Ali's initial target was, would you believe it, MP Michael Gove. And the reason for this is he had basically voted in favour of military action against the Islamic State in both 2014 and 2015. Ali had even established where Michael Gove lived, and he'd even come up with various alternatives of how to kill him in a terrorist attack. So he's really planning this. He's fantasising about exactly how it's going to play out. He's pinpointed the individual that he feels deserves to die. And he's chosen somebody of high importance in the government. Even if you don't know politics, even if it's not really your interest area, Michael Gove is somebody's name that you will have heard of. However, because the pandemic hit and there were all these restrictions that were imposed on movement, that curtailed his plans. So essentially, the case I'm talking about today could have been very different. I could have been talking about the horrific murder of Michael Gove. So Ali continues then to research online. He needs to figure out something that will fit in with this pandemic situation. So he starts researching other various potential MP targets. On the 9th of March 2021 to the 5th of July 2021, Ali carries out reconnaissance in the area of Michael Gove's address on 8 separate occasions. However, in spite of this, he ultimately abandons the idea of killing Gove. And the reason for this is because he's actually moved away from the area. He's got a divorce. So this means with the pandemic issues that it just isn't going to work for him. But sliding doors moment for Gove there, isn't it? Because Ali is absolutely intent on going ahead and murdering an MP. And he literally went to the address that Gove used to live. And if it hadn't been for the breakdown in his relationship, well, the chances are he'd be telling this story about Michael Gove today. Between the 15th of July 2021 and the 22nd of September 2021, well, Ali starts carrying out a reconnaissance around the Houses of Parliament. This is on 8 occasions. This is where he's observing where the MPs enter, where they leave Parliament, and he's thinking to himself, well, maybe I could carry out an attack here. But he decides this is going to be a problem. Because imagine, when you were anywhere around the Parliament, you are going to see lots of armed guards. I mean, they are everywhere. Security had been increased anyway because there have been quite a few previous attacks around that area. So you have armed police on every single entrance. And that was since the death of PC Keith Palmer. He was killed in a fatal knife attack by Khalid Massoud. That was on the 22nd of March 2017. I'm sure that some of you remember that. And what happened was the unarmed police officer was somebody who confronted Massoud because Massoud was there with two knives, and this incredibly brave unarmed police officer was purely there to serve and protect. And I mean that in the most honest and congruent of ways. You know, he didn't have any way of protecting himself, but he confronted that man who was stood with two knives and he got killed in that struggle. But because he sacrificed himself without a doubt, he managed to delay Massoud long enough for a minister's bodyguard to arrive on the scene and actually shoot Massoud dead. When that happened, Massoud had actually killed 5 people and he'd injured over 50 on that day during the Westminster Bridge attack. If ever I can highlight how dangerous these lone wolves are, it's in that summing up. It's also really important to just take a moment and to remember and hold in ultimate respect the police officer who actually did that day. I think it is such a rare trait in a human being who has a job, and literally that job can at times mean that they become physically harmed, but to literally sacrifice themselves to prevent somebody else and even more people dying is just beyond heroism, as far as I'm concerned. Now, between July and September of 2021, Ali is still at hard work researching MPs online. And on the 19th and the 22nd of July 2021, he researches MP Sir David Amiss. Now, that's for the first time. This is the first time he has actually looked at this particular MP. Also, he's researching at this point the stabbing of MP Stephen Timms during one of his constituency surgeries in May 2020. Ali, therefore, links these and decides that he's going to do the same. MPs, for people who aren't in the UK, hold surgeries. That's where they sit, in a community place, in their constituency, and people come and talk to them about issues that they've got, ask them for help in certain matters, and it's basically a way of them engaging with the public. When you want votes, you want to make sure that you are known in your local area, so surgeries are really important. They also mean that the MP is always going to be at risk. People get really angry about certain matters, so they're always being put in a position of potential harm. But on the whole, because we are pro-social creatures, and even when we're really angry about things, we don't tend to act in violent ways, on the whole, incidents where MPs are attacked are rare. But what is the big problem with the surgeries, on both the positive and negative, is that, you know, when you go and visit your local MP, you don't necessarily want armed guards everywhere, do you? It's a scary kind of feeling. But it does mean that this happens to result in them not having guards around them. Also, an MP is never armed, and they're very easily accessible. And for Ali, well, that's perfect, because he wants to be able to go ahead and do what he is planning in his fantasy to do. It gets to late September 2021, and at this point, Ali puts together a note, and it's a note that explains the actions for the terror attack that he's planning to carry out. And in it, he states that it was for the sake of Allah. And it read, "I apologise to my family for deceiving them for so long. I would have preferred hijra, which is travel, so as not to harm you, but I could not. The obligations upon me to take revenge for the blood of Muslims was too great. The shame of abiding in the very lands that carry out these horrendous acts against my brothers and sisters was too much." So he plans to release it along with a link to a film about Raqqa when the time was right. But you can hear from what he's saying in that note that he feels that even though he has been brought up in this family, even though he has had the privileges and freedoms of this country, the UK, he has this seething resentment because he doesn't consider himself a part of the UK. He sees his brothers and sisters as individuals who are in other countries facing the acts that he considers are violent from our country. On the 22nd of September 2021, there is CCTV footage, and it's basically Ali walking around Westminster. You can see his shoulder bag, so clearly we would be able to assume that his knife is inside that shoulder bag. By the 27th of September 2021, Ali has selected his target. It's going to be 69-year-old MP Sir David Amiss, and he intends to carry out the murder at his constituency's surgery in Lay-on-Sea. The whole premise of the way he's going to kill him is to stab Sir David to death, and then he's going to martyr himself. So in his head, he's decided that what will occur is he'll kill Sir David and then he'll get shot by armed police because he's going to attack them too, and that will result in him getting shot dead in the process. Bit of a spoiler for this guy. He doesn't live in America, but never mind. Obviously hasn't thought that through. And yes, I do appreciate, guys, that we do have armed police in the UK. And on very rare occasions, an individual will be shot by the firearms police officers. The reason it is so rare is because the process that needs to be gone through for an individual to be told, yes, you can shoot that person, is enormous. They can't just turn up and shoot somebody. It doesn't work that way. And I know a lot about what happens to an individual who goes ahead and shoots somebody, even when they've been told to shoot somebody and notified that it's okay to do so. The process after they've actually shot somebody is pretty traumatizing for them. They get suspended, yes, on full pay, but they investigate whether it was a legal thing to do. So we do not, in the UK, take it lightly when somebody gets shot. Now, before I talk about how this crime plays out, it would be remiss of me not to talk about Sir David, because he was a really special man. He was born in London's East End in 1952. He came from a relatively poor background. His parents didn't have a great deal of money. He aspired to make a difference to the world and to be more, to make something of himself. He married his wife, Julia, in 1983, and they had 5 children together. He was a real family man. They had David, Catherine, Sarah, Alexandra, and Florence. So this was a man very committed to his family. He was somebody who, you know, earlier on when I was talking about some kids just have a knowledge of what they want to be, who they want to be, and they decide it when they're a kid and they just go for it, right? That's exactly what this man was like. He'd been an MP for 38 years, and he had known that he wanted to be an MP from a really young age. As a youth, he even founded his own political party called the Revolutionist Party. And the key demands of the Revolutionist Party were for a minimum pocket money and the abolition of homework. I would have followed him to the very end of the earth. He was the kind of politician every child could buy into. Anyone who wants to give you a certain amount of pocket money and prevent teachers from giving you homework is my kind of guy. But obviously, it demonstrates that there was a leadership value about him even from the beginning, and somebody who wanted justice for all, as far as I'm concerned, with those kind of demands. He joined the Conservative Party when he was 16, and he was first elected to Parliament in 1983. He had been the MP for Southend West since 1997. Before that, he represented the Basildon constituency. He was a real prominent backbencher. Something that I really align with him on was that he was a huge supporter of animal welfare. He had several pets as well, something that he and I have in common. He included a French bulldog called Vivian. I know. I like anyone who has a French bulldog and calls them Vivian. I like the idea of walking in a park when your dog is off the lead and you just have to shout, Vivian, and like several people turn around because they're like, oh, where's Vivian? My mum's called Vivian, I'm called Vivian, my wife's called Vivian, but it's actually a French bulldog. I always think names are interesting like that. It's like if you called a Staffordshire Bull Mark, you know? No one expects a Staffordshire Bulldog or any bulldog to be called Mark, but if you did it, it would be quite fun shouting the name in a park just to see how many people answered. Another thing that he was really committed to was he wanted to end fuel poverty, which again is powerful because so many people struggle heating, and every single winter we see old people dying because they are cold. And that's before we even think about the impact of petrol prices and how that impacts on people's capacities to get to work. And right now we need somebody like this man because the world has gone a little bit insane and you need MPs who fight for the rights of the ordinary human being. He was really well regarded to such a degree that he actually received a knighthood in 2015 for political and public service. And it's very hard to get knighthoods on the whole. I know, I don't know how Tony Blair got one. For those of you who don't know who Tony Blair is in the UK, just Google him and then Google the petition that got signed when everyone wanted him to have it taken off him. But most of the time, aside from when people like Sir Tony Blair are granted these kind of things, it's really hard to get a knighthood. It demonstrates that he had a pledge to the world around him and that the people who knew him believed that his intentions were full of integrity and he was somebody who went out of his way to make a difference positively to the world around him. Now, back to Ali. We know he has got this festering resentment and he's made this decision that he wants to end the life of an MP. So he makes a plan to visit Sir David's surgery. Between the 27th and the 30th of September 2021, he starts having email contact with Rebecca Hayton. Now, Rebecca Hayton was a member of Sir David's staff. Ali, at this point, wants to disguise who he is to some degree, so he gives a false address. He claims to be a healthcare worker who's moving to the area. Now, think about that during the pandemic. Very manipulative. How many times has the average person had it drummed into them that anyone who works in any caring field is literally a hero, right? And that means you have this bias about how to treat that individual. And he knows that. He knows that that will make him seem like a good human being. This means that he'll be given a trusted place in the mindset of the person that he's communicating with. And basically, he says that he wants to know plans for hospitals and hospital workers. He also says that he's interested in Christianity. He expresses that he's got quite a lot of concern about churches that are falling into disrepair or being repurposed. Again, that's helping the person who's on the receiving end of those messages think, oh, this is a really pro-social guy. You're not alerting this individual to any potential terrorism because you're talking about quite the contrary, Christianity. You're even interested in the fact that a lot of these churches are being repurposed. And because he's obviously suggesting that he's going to be moving to the area, he's asking whether this future MP of his isn't going to take too long to deal with these issues. Therefore, after gaining the trust of this particular individual who works with Sir David, he arranges to meet with him at his constituency surgery at Belfair's Methodist Church in Lay-on-Sea. This is at 12 p.m. on Friday, the 15th of October. And you can imagine, as far as those who are involved are concerned, this makes perfect sense. This is just an individual who's really interested in what work the MP is doing and whether that individual can buy into the MP based on that information and that experience. Now, in the interim, Ali is continuing to research his target. He's getting really fixated with this. Bear in mind, this is not just somebody who is selecting an individual to murder. It's not a random killing. He wants to have a sense of just killing. This is an individual who believes that he has a moral conscience and capacity to go ahead and do this. He is justifying his target constantly. And also, he's researching other terrorist stabbings. In fact, one of the things that he manages to do in his research is he establishes that Sir David works closely with the Jewish community in his constituency. He also finds out that he's previously served as the Honorary Secretary of Conservative Friends of Israel. Also was a massive long-term supporter and a campaigner for the Holocaust Educational Trust. Now, that is commendable full stop. The fact that he goes out of his way as an MP to involve himself in communities that he doesn't necessarily belong to, but that he has massive respect towards. And of course, the fact that he wants to make sure that people are educated about the Holocaust, one of the worst, heinous tragedies that generations have ever encountered, that says something really commendable about this individual. But for Ali, well, the connection to the Jewish community is just another example of why he's allowed to kill Sir David, because he finds that reprehensible. He's angered by the fact that he has these connections. On the 15th of October 2021, Ali wakes up at 4 a.m. He sets off from his home in Kentish Town and he goes to pray at a local mosque. Now, later that day, Sir David Amos is holding his constituency surgery in Leigh-on-Sea. Just 4 weeks earlier, Sir David Amos had watched his daughter Alexandra get married. That celebration had just occurred. That watching his girl, all grown up, walking down the aisle with the man of her dreams, and he was part of that. So much to celebrate. CCTV catches 25-year-old Ali walking along a North London street. He's wearing a long green parka jacket. He's got a black backpack on his shoulder. It's containing that knife. He's on his way to Gospel Oak train station. At this point, he takes a train to Barking, then another to Leigh-on-Sea. He arrives about an hour and a half before his appointment with Sir David, and then he walks to where his target waits for him. He actually gets there early, so he ends up standing and just looking at the sea for half an hour. It's strange to imagine that, isn't it? For me, when I look at the sea, it calms me. The power of Mother Nature, the way that she's uncontrollable and yet beautiful, dangerous and yet so peaceful. And yet for him, it does nothing. It doesn't make him reconsider. That time that he has, where he can walk away, back away, call somebody, admit what he thinks and feels, take a step back and just allow himself to consider the enormity of what he's been planning, the repercussions on him, the repercussions on his family. But no, he just watches the sea and it changes nothing. Shortly before midday, Ali enters Belfast Methodist Church. He goes to the toilet before sitting in the waiting area. At this point, he's met by Sir David's constituency assistant, Julie Cushion, and she's lovely to him. She chats to him about his imminent move to the area. She's very welcoming. And then he meets Rebecca Hayton, who he's been in email contact with. Again, she's so pleasant, chats to him. Obviously, she's not afraid. She has no idea of what's going on in this young man's mind. And she leads him to the office at the back of the church that Sir David was using. And when he gets there, Sir David greets him really warmly. That was how Sir David was with every single one of his constituents. If you speak to people who went to his surgeries, who spent time with him, it was his warmth that stood out. He was a good man. After Sir David has greeted him warmly, he sits down with him. Ali sits down at the desk and Sir David and Rebecca Hayton sit on the other side of the desk. And according to Rebecca, Ali just seemed completely relaxed, completely at ease. But if you think about how he should be feeling in this moment, relaxed is as far from what we would imagine. And that intrigues me because I imagine that you have to have some personality traits. Not just simply that you're somebody who's been radicalized and therefore you believe what you are doing. I fully understand that people can be radicalized and they can fully commit to what they want to do, but they are still terrified. They are still nervous. They will be sweating. They will be on edge. The fact that this young man is completely at ease, that says there is something malevolent about his personality. It's latent, potentially. People might not have noticed it in the past. Only as he starts to get into later teenagehood do people start to see him slide a little. But to me, there is something malevolent in his nature. That he can be sat after luring these innocent human beings into a sense of safety, knowing all the while what you were about to do. After about 5 minutes into the meeting, Ali begins playing with his phone. Now, unknown to Sir David at this point, Ali actually sends a message to his family on WhatsApp. It's that note that I talked about earlier on, the one that he composed together with the link to the Raqqa film. He then places the phone on the table. Sir David, at this point, understandably, when he sees the mobile phone on the table, asks Ali if he was recording him. Ali would later state that Sir David probably thought it was another brass eye style sting, because back in the day in 1997, Sir David had been duped by Chris Morris's Brass Eye programme, and he'd been tricked into recording a message warning of the dangers of a new drug, cake. Obviously, that was a joke, but the point was, Sir David actually believed that there was a problem, and because he was so pro-social and concerned, he genuinely did it for all the right reasons. And his genuineness and eagerness to help was actually reflected when he later raised his concerns about cats, GHB and cake in Parliament. But again, the fact that it was a joke that he was involved in, he was unaware of, that's irrelevant. This is a man who cared deeply about what was happening in society. And he went to Parliament to try to make a difference. And although that particular edition of cake, obviously, on reflection, was something I bet he wished he'd researched, he just trusted people. And again, that's reflected in the way he is in this moment. He trusts Ali. And you can just imagine for a second that there Sir David is potentially thinking that this might just be a little bit of a joke, that Ali's just there for the crack. But actually, this was no comedy sting. This was so far from a comedy sting that I don't even think in Sir David's wildest imagination he could have ever connected the dots. Sir David then asks Ali if they'd spoken on the phone. He asks him, what made you want to move to Southend? Ali at this point says that he trained as a radiographer and said he was moving by himself and that he wants to basically settle in the area before he starts a family. At this point, Ali then moves the conversation onto foreign politics. And the witness said that it did at this point start to annoy Sir David a little bit. He felt that the point that was being made by Ali wasn't really part of what they'd agreed to talk about. And it was getting into a subject area that he wasn't necessarily very comfortable talking about. In fact, he ended up saying to Ali, the purpose of this surgery really is not to discuss politics. Ali replied at this point and says that he wants to talk about foreign affairs and says to Sir David that he knows that he supported the Iraq war, but that he changed his mind. At this point, Sir David apparently just looked confused. Then, at approximately 12:05, Ali stood up and said, sorry. Just takes a knife from his bag, without warning, just launches into a frenzied attack. From nowhere. And the fact that he apologises seems so strange. To actually say sorry before you literally murder someone. I don't know whether that was because Ali was so decided on this course of action. It didn't matter how Sir David came across in that meeting. He was gonna go and do it anyway. He was going to kill Sir David. But I wonder, because of the warmth, the engagement, the kindness that Sir David demonstrated as an individual, even though Ali knew he was going to murder him, in that moment, did he also recognise that when it came down to it, this man genuinely did not deserve it? Not that anyone ever deserves to be murdered, but certainly this upstanding citizen, this individual who's literally worked his whole life for a better country and had warmly greeted him in that situation. Sir David stood absolutely no chance in this attack. It was unprovoked. It was completely unexpected. He was completely unprepared. First of all, Ali stabs him in the stomach. Sir David screams out. And then Ali just repeatedly stabs him. And it's not like Sir David didn't fight back. My God, he did. He put up a valiant fight to fend off this attacker. But Ali was significantly younger. He was larger than Sir David. And also, he was armed. He stabbed Sir David more than 20 times. And he focused on the areas where the major blood vessels were located. In fact, he did that because he'd been trained by the Islamic State training videos to do that. That's why he stabbed them in those areas, because he'd been trained to do so. Sir David suffered multiple deep stab wounds. They were catastrophic. The pathologist later confirmed that Sir David suffered wounds to his cheek, neck, shoulder, armpit, stomach, back, and his chest. One of the stab wounds actually punctured his lung. And Ali would later say that the finisher, as he put it, was a stab wound to his neck. Throughout that attack, Sir David just kept saying, no, no, no. Ali didn't say a word. And after he had carried out that unprovoked, undeserved attack, Ali just sat back calmly and he prayed with his blood-soaked hands just waiting for the police to arrive. Rebecca Hayton, who'd been witness to this, had managed to escape from the office during the assault, and she is screaming for Julie Cushion to call the police. Can you imagine how traumatised she is? She's just witnessed a man that she deeply respects, a colleague, a friend, be brutalised in this way by a man that she had email conversations with, that she had invited to the surgery, that she had taken to Sir David's office. And now he's dead. Meanwhile, Ali's sister's received this WhatsApp message and she's calling him hysterically. This is not what the family are expecting. They are not guilty of radicalization. This is a man who has been radicalized without them having any knowledge of it. Two other constituents, Darren King and Yvonne Eves, have also arrived because they're meant to have a meeting with Sir David. They hear what's happened. They go to see if they can help him. It's at this point they come face to face with Ali, and he's on the phone to his sister. He's waving the knife about and he's shouting, I killed him. I killed him. And they look and they see Sir David, and he's just crumpled on the floor behind Ali. Ali refuses to let them near him. In fact, he threatens to kill them, threatens to stab the police officers when they arrive. And he tells them that he'd acted in revenge for bombings in Syria. He claimed he wanted to kill everyone who'd voted in favour of military action. And then he says he wants to be shot by the police. Darren King at this point bravely tries to calm him down. And he tells Ali this, we're not in America, we're in England, mate. And he's right. People don't just get shot in England. He even asks why he wants to die. And then he asked him, how would your sister feel if you were killed? And Ali responds with this, I'm going to be a martyr. I'm going to die a hero. And Darren replied, no, you're just going to be dead, mate. Is it me? Is it just me that actually finds that even in circumstances of such horror, British people can't help but be very sarcastic? This guy has just brutalised and murdered this innocent, good human being who had literally just celebrated the wedding of his daughter. And in that moment, when he's sitting there with his ego inflating that he's a martyr, he's going to die a hero, and Darren just can't resist. Bear in mind, dealing with an armed man. And even in that moment, it's just like, nah, you're no hero, mate. You're just going to be dead. Ali actually stays on that mobile phone to his sister for about 1/4 hour And again, we have to remember that for her, she's dealing with the trauma personally. She's trying to calm him down. She doesn't want her brother dead. She can't believe what he's done. But she's also a part of this story. She's trying to get him to de-escalate. Yvonne Eves, she calls the police. And in her frantic 999 call, she tells the handler that Sir David has been killed at Belfair's church. And she says that the attacker's still there with a large kitchen knife, is still armed. And she also said he's not letting anyone go near Sir David. And she said he's wielding the knife now. He said if we don't leave, he'll stab us, me and my partner and the two ladies for the constituency here. He tells the call handler that he's saying he wants to be a hero and he wants the police to come and kill him. So she's kind of getting all that information across. Now, the first police to actually arrive on the scene were both unarmed, plainclothes Essex police officers. That's PCs Scott and Curtis. In fact, they only had their police batons and parva spray. It's like a pepper spray. And the body cam footage shows when they enter the church and when they end up getting confronted by Ali. He's brandishing the murder weapon, the kitchen knife. Ali advances towards the two officers, and whilst they retreat a little bit, they do stand the ground. Now, following this continuous conversation with his sister, she's pleading for him, please drop the knife, please stop this. He finally does drop the knife. And the two officers at this point charge him, they take him down, and they arrest him on suspicion of murder. Again, personally, when I look at Ali in this situation, I think surely you're going to be in a state of agitation. But no, he's just really calm throughout his arrest. And at one point, whilst he's restrained on the floor, he actually asks the officers to put his glasses on his face for him. His phone is also ringing and it's his family. And he actually shouts into the phone that the police had him, that he was okay, that he hadn't been shot. Once he's actually apprehended, shows absolutely no remorse whatsoever. Quite the contrary, if I'm honest. He's really smug, he's really self-satisfied, he's really happy with what he's done. He had decided that he was going to kill this innocent MP, and he's gone ahead and succeeded. And he is gloating about that. Meanwhile, the paramedics have arrived, and clearly they are desperately trying to save Sir David, but he gets pronounced dead at the scene at 1:10 p.m., which is just beyond tragic. We're talking about a father of five who was just doing his job, who was just opening his door to the public so that they could come and complain or ask for guidance and so on and so forth. And now he's been stabbed 20 times and he's dead. Ali gets taken to the police station, and when he's being booked in, he tells the officers that the attack had been an act of terror on religious grounds. At this point, he is detained under terrorism legislation. Now, during the police interview, again, Ali remains, in my opinion, weirdly calm. He tells the police officers that he bottled previous planned attacks on MPs, and he made it very clear why he wanted to kill. He described in detail how he carried out the attack, and he stated that the reasoning behind it was because of the bombs of Islamic State fighters. He also said that he'd done it because he wanted to influence politicians. Just gonna put it out there, Ali. What we tend to think when people kill people is that said killer needs to be put away forever. We don't think, ooh, he's gone ahead and killed somebody. Maybe he's got some good political points that he wants to express. Maybe we should listen to him. In fact, hang on, Ali, we'll just get number 10 on the phone. Prime Minister wants to chat. Forget it, not just the Prime Minister. President of the United States, get Macron involved as well. I don't know, the whole of Europe, that group, certainly Nicola Sturgeon will want a chat. You know, that is literally not going to happen. But nonetheless, this is the radicalisation, this is the reasoning. And he said, it made me think that, okay, you could just stab regular Joe on the corner, you know, Sally, soccer mum, Joe, six pack, those sort of people. But, you know, the actual people that made the decisions, they go back to their second homes. They go back to their wives, their children. Okay. So does Sally the soccer mum. But at the end of the day, that was his logic. His logic was that at the end of the day, these politicians make these decisions and there are consequences, and in spite of these consequences, they don't have to suffer them. So now I'm going to make a politician suffer the consequences. I'm going to make their children suffer the consequences. And he continues to show absolutely no remorse. In fact, let's just call it as it is. This guy is proud of what he's done. And just think about that for a moment. He's proud of attacking a defenseless elderly man who wanted to help people. He genuinely believed it was a good deed that he had eradicated the world of this human who was so humane, he committed his life to service. That's how delusional Ali was. I mean, Ali isn't a martyr, he's a murderer, simple as. He went on to say, obviously I've killed someone, there's no doubt about that, but it still doesn't feel like it. Maybe it's because I feel justified in what I've done. He even told police that it was almost like an out-of-body experience. He said, it felt like 1 minute I was sat down at the table talking to him, and the next he was dead. But yeah, it's probably one of the strangest days of my life now, you know? I just remember stabbing him a few times and in the places where I stabbed him. I mean, he genuinely sounds like he's recalling a shopping list. We're talking about the death of an innocent man. We're talking about a man who took a 12-inch knife into an office of an unsuspecting elderly gentleman and then stabbed him to death. There was no heroism there. There was no martyrdom there. It was a cold-blooded killing of an innocent gentleman. Now, during the police investigation, they found Telegram messages from November 2016 on Ali's phone, and it called for people to wage jihad with knives, guns, explosives to kill the Crusaders. So investigators also managed to unearth other content at the same time, which is all related to Islamic State, which is terrifying. There are literally Telegram groups where kids can get radicalized. And bear in mind, we're talking about an adult male at this point. Think about the 13, 14, 15-year-old people who have got access to this kind of craziness. On the 21st of October 2021, Ali gets charged with murder and charged with preparing terrorist acts. Now, despite the conclusive evidence against him and Ali's own confessions, he pleads not guilty to all charges. I mean, you see, it's moments like this, guys, that I just think the law doesn't need to be fair. Genuinely, I'm a big believer in law and justice and law and order and the fact that there are protocols and systems to go through. I get it. It's important because otherwise innocent people could end up in prison. Sometimes they do anyway. Sometimes people who are guilty as hell get to walk free. But arguably, this is the way the system works. But when it comes down to someone getting caught bang to rights, literally on CCTV, witnessed by individuals who literally saw him slay Sir David, police officers who actually had to apprehend him, and then on top of that, him telling the police that he'd literally stabbed Sir David and that it had been a strange day, but he remembered it all. Do we really need a trial? Do we really need one? Is it not fair to say you don't get to say you're not guilty? We've got a confession from you. And on top of that, everybody saw. So no, you're not getting a trial. You're just going to prison forever. You're a very dangerous man. Personally, I'd be cool with that on these occasions. Because the idea that he gets to plead not guilty means that Sir David's family have to undergo the ordeal of a trial. How dare he? How dare he be given the counsel to defend him? How dare he be given his day in court to have a trial where the family have to see and hear all the significant horrors that led to the death of their loved parent, their loved partner? Because that's what he does. Now, when the trial gets to the Old Bailey, listen, prosecutors tell the jury that the evidence against Ali was utterly overwhelming and compelling. They described him as a bloodthirsty Islamic State-supporting murderer and extremist, which he is. Now in court, again, Ali is weirdly relaxed and calm. And what's even more sinister, he's often seen smiling. It's like he is enjoying reliving his attack on Sir David. He's getting some sadistic pleasure at replaying it. And that must have been beyond devastating for Sir David's family. Again, I know it's highly inappropriate and unprofessional to say this, but I do feel when people are like that in court, and we know that they are absolutely bang to rights guilty, and that they are wasting a lot of taxpayers' money, and that they are traumatising innocent family members of the victim, that potentially people should be allowed to throw darts at the person who did its head. I know it's not something that we do. I'm just saying that if we did, it would make some people feel better about these situations. Probably won't be something that I go for Prime Minister on, though. Although I know a lot of you listening will completely understand that there would be some satisfaction at going for the bullseye in Ali's forehead with some darts. Just throwing it out there. The 11th of April, 2022. You know how long it takes for the jury to go away and have a think about this? How long does it take the jury to leave and be like, is he guilty? Is he not guilty? Does anybody think he's not guilty? Good, because if any of you thought he was not guilty, I'd have to throw darts at your head. I'm joking. Obviously, you can't do that to the jury either. Unless they genuinely did think he was not guilty, in which case something should happen. Sorry, I'm being sarcastic and I shouldn't be. It's a very serious issue. But it takes them 18 minutes. Yeah, 18 minutes. And we all agree, don't we, that at least five of those will have been walking to the place that they sit down. Three of those will have been getting comfortable. Two of those will just all be nodding their head and going, should we walk back there? And then they're back in the room. That's how long it took. So the jury find him guilty of Sir David's murder and planning an act of terror. And you won't be surprised to realise that Ali remained emotionless as the verdict was passed. Because Ali has no soul. Ali is just a massive piece of rock. Where his soul should be, there is just a great big black void of nothing. Which is ironic, because he thought he could be a martyr, get jihad, and, you know, be off with the virgins and all of that. But as it happens, you have to have a soul to actually achieve that. So, sorry, Ali. It's just going to be nothingness forever for you. On the 13th of April, 2022, Ali gets sentenced and he faces a mandatory life sentence for murder. Also, he faced the potential maximum life sentence for terrorism charges. Judge Mr. Justice Sweeney, well, they have to determine the minimum term that Ali's going to serve before being eligible for parole. Now, murder is obviously a serious offence every day of the week. However, the nature of Sir David's murder meant seriousness was exceptionally high. So, first of all, it had been for the advancing of a religious or ideological cause. It was committed for the purposes of terrorism. It had been vastly premeditated. I mean, Ali had meticulously planned it literally for years. And he'd even purchased the murder weapon 5 years earlier. He'd gone armed with the weapon. That's a further aggravating factor. And his victim, his poor, innocent victim, had been killed when he was just carrying out a public service. He was serving his constituency. And the attack had been in revenge for Sir David carrying out his duty. His duty as an MP. He was killed for voting on proposals in Parliament. That's essentially the reason he was murdered. Ali had also, during the attack, when he'd ended it, prevented people actually giving any medical aid to Sir David. So he wasn't even given a right to be helped. Ultimately, that meant there was only one sentence that could be imposed, and that was a full life term. The judge stated this. This was a murder that struck at the heart of our democracy. I have no doubt whatsoever that this is an exceptional case in which the element of just punishment requires the imposition of a whole life order, such that the defendant must be kept in prison for the rest of his life. Ali also received a concurrent life sentence for terrorism charges with a minimum term of 30 years. Not that he needs it, because he ain't going nowhere. Gonna have a lot of time to sit in a cell having a think about, you know, that martyrdom that he thought he was going to achieve, isn't he? A lot of time for that great big soulless lump of a rock to just meditate on such values. Now, following Sir David's death, Boris Johnson said that the constituency he represented, which was Southend-on-Sea, would be made a city in his honour. And the reason for that, which is quite emotional actually when you think about it, is that Sir David had spent a lot of years fighting really hard to give Southend-on-Sea a city status. So even though he never got to see that in his life, it was the work that he had done that had made that possible, because even though it's his death that actually gave that stamp of approval to the city status, it will be forever remembered because it was Sir David who actually worked hard to create that. Sir David as well was the second MP to have been killed doing their job. So another MP who was killed was 41-year-old Labour MP Jo Cox. She was murdered in 2016. And she was killed by 53-year-old white supremacist Thomas Alexander Mair. He actually shot her twice in the head, once in the chest, and he stabbed her 15 times. Again, all she was doing was her job, and she ended up being brutalised that way. Sir David's murder has been seen, and rightfully so, as an attack against democracy, an attack on our very way of life, which it absolutely was. But first and foremost, and more important than any of that, it's the brutal murder of a loving family man. He was an MP, but he was so much more. He was a really much loved husband. He was an adored father. And his children and his wife, they are the biggest losers in this story. And to know that they sent that man out doing a job that he loved and was committed to, and he was and will always be known as a really good man. Whatever your politics are, look at the individual behind those politics. And this particular individual, wow, he was a good human being. He is a massive loss, not just to his constituency, but to the government, because let me tell you, we all know that there are some wrong'uns in government, but he wasn't. He was always on the right side of history and his beliefs. And I cannot even begin to contemplate the agony that his family have experienced and the agony they were put through having to go and see that excuse for a human put them through a trial. Unforgivable. And I hope that Ali has a very long life. Very, very long life. Because I think over time, And I think as he sees people come into prison and leave prison, and he gets older and greyer and lonelier, he may reconsider what he believes his martyr status really stands for. Because he will be long forgotten, where Sir David will be remembered as a legacy for aeons to come. We'll remember Sir David's name. Ali, he'll just become another nobody that no one cares about. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.